Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 32. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we have a great story for you. The Experiment in Gyro Hats by Ellis Parker Butler. And if you like the sound of Jules Verne-style Victorian machinery mixed with a Mark Twain sense of humour, this story should be perfect for you. Ellis Parker Butler was born December 5th, 1869, and died September 13th, 1937. He was an American author responsible for more than 30 books and more than 2,000 stories and essays, including most famously his short story Pigs is Pigs, in which a bureaucratic station master insists on levying the livestock rate for a shipment of two pet guinea pigs, which soon start proliferating geometrically. I have wondered if this is what inspired the famous The Trouble with Tribbles Star Trek episode. His career spanned more than 40 years, and his stories, poems, and articles were published in more than 225 magazines. His work appears alongside of that of contemporaries like Mark Twain, Sax Rohmer, James B. Hendricks, Burton Braley, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Don Marquis, Will Rogers, and Edgar Rice Burroughs. Despite the enormous volume of his work, Butler was, for most of his life, only a part-time author. While working full-time as a banker, he was still very active in his local community, and as a founding member of both the Dutch Treat Club and the Authors League of America, Butler was an always-present force in the New York City literary scene. He wrote 25 stories for Women's Home Companion between 1906 and 1935, but our story was published in Amazing Stories, Volume 1, Number 3. Our narrator is Logan Waterman. Logan has a degree in technical theatre from California State University and has worked in many theatres, large and small, professional and amateur. He has also worked for Apple Computers, sold hot tubs and comic books, and prepared court documents. He has taught sword fighting for the stage and run lights for a local band until they broke up. He currently works, tangentially, for the legal system, watches a lot of science fiction television, listens to a lot of podcasts, and reads a lot of science fiction novels and comic books. He hopes to make a bit of money from voice acting and narrating someday. Logan currently lives in North California with Grendel, a huge black beast whose primary occupations are sleeping, stalking the fish in the aquarium, and keeping the house safe from the hordes of invisible monsters that come out every night, and Morgana, a small, fluffy queen who rules her domain with an iron paw. The fish remain unimpressed. So charge your coils and tip your silk topper. It's time for The Experiment in Gyro Hats by Ellis Parker Butler.
The idea of a gyro hat did not come to me all at once, as some great ideas come to inventors. And in fact, I may say that, but for a most unpleasant circumstance, I might never have thought of gyro hats at all, although I had for many years been considering the possibility of utilizing the waste space in the top of silk hats in some way or other. As a practical hat dealer and a lover of my kind, it had always seemed to me a great economical waste to have a large vacant space inside the upper portions of top hats, or high hats, or stovepipe hats, as they are variously called. When a shoe is on, it is full of foot. When a glove is on, it is full of hand. But a top hat is not, and can never be, full of head until such a day as heads assume a cylindrical shape perfectly flat on top, and no sensible man ever expects that day to come. I had, therefore, spent much of my leisure in devising methods by which the vacant space above the head in high hats might be turned to advantage, and my patents ranged all the way from a small filing cabinet that just occupied the waste space to an extensible hat rack on the accordion plan that could be pushed compactly to the top of the top hat when the hat was worn, but could be extended into a hat and coat rack when the hat was not in use. This idea should have been very popular, but I may say that the public received the idea coldly. My attention had for some time drawn away from this philanthropic work by certain symptoms of uneasiness I noticed in my daughter Anne, and my wife and I decided, after careful consideration, that Anne must be in love, and that her love must be unhappy. Otherwise, we could not account for the strange excitability of our usually imperturbable daughter. As a practical hat dealer, my time had been almost exclusively devoted to hats, and as a good wife, my companion's attention had been almost exclusively devoted to her husband, while Anne was usually so calm and self-contained that she did not take my attention from my hat business at all. But when such a daughter suddenly develops signs of weeping and sighs and general nervousness, any father, no matter how devoted to the hat trade, must pay attention. One of the primary necessities of a dealer in good hats is calm. An ordinary hat dealer may not need calm. He may buy his hats as another dealer buys flour, in bulk, and then trust to advertisements to sell them. But I am not that kind of hat dealer. Hat dealing is an art with me, and great art requires calm and peace in order that it may reach its highest development. When I buy hats, I do not think of dozens and dollars, no, indeed. I think of noses and ears. To be able to buy a manufacturer a hat that will make the pug nose and big ears of a man I have never seen seem normal and beautiful when that man enters my store and buys a hat requires calm. And no hatter can have calm in his soul while his daughter is lovesick and unhappy. I demand happiness about and around me, and I must have it. So I told my wife, and I told her so most emphatically, and I informed her that Anne must be happy at once. Perhaps you can imagine the shock I received when my wife, after making the necessary inquiries of Anne, informed me that Anne was indeed in love, and in love with Walshingham Gribbs. It was not because Walshingham Gribbs had never bought a hat of me that I was shocked. Bad hats are a common failing of mankind, and a man will try 100 hatters before he at last comes to me. The trouble was deeper than this. The thing that staggered me was that Walshingham was a staggerer. This is a joke, but I hold that a hatter has as good a right to make a joke as the next man. That my daughter had fallen in love with Walshingham Gribbs without having met him was altogether to her credit. She first saw him when she was crossing the ocean, for she travels where she pleases, my hat business affording her such pleasures. And that he reeled and staggered about the boat did not impress her, for it was a stormy trip and everyone aboard reeled and staggered, even the captain of the boat. But when she returned to New York and saw Walshingham Gribbs on the firm pavement of Fifth Avenue, she had a harsh, cruel disillusionment. Walshingham Gribbs reeled and staggered on terra firma. I am glad to say that my daughter saw at once the impossibility of the daughter of a high-class hatter mating with a permanent staggerer. As she realized this, she became sad and nervous, thus creating an atmosphere in my home which was quite opposed to the best high-class hatting, irritating my faculties, and threatening to reduce me to a state of mere commercial hatter. Further investigation only made the matter seem worse, for inquiries brought out the information that Walshingham Gribbs had been staggering since the year his father died. He had been constantly in a reeling, staggering state since his 20th birthday. For such a man, reform is, indeed, impossible. And what made the case more sad was that all proof seemed to point to the fact that Walshingham Gribbs was not a bounder nor a rounder, two classes of men who occasionally acquire a stagger and a reel in company with hardy boon companions. In short, no one had ever seen Walshingham Gribbs take a drink in public, and I was forced to conclude that he was of that horrid type that drinks alone, alone but with unabated zeal, as the great poet Sir Walter Scott had remarked in one of his charming poems. If all these investigations of mine were conducted without the knowledge of Walshingham Gribbs, you must admit that I only did what was right in keeping them a secret from him. For since he had never met my daughter, he might have considered the efforts of a perfect stranger to peer into his life as being uncalled for. My wife did what she could to comfort Anne, but Anne sadly replied that she could never marry a man that staggered and reeled day in and day out. Thus, day by day, she became more sad, and I became so upset that I actually sold a narrow-brimmed derby hat to a man with wide, outstanding ears. Of course, this could not go on. No high-grade hat business could support it. And I was standing in my shop door, looking gloomily out, when I chanced to see Walshingham Gribbs stagger by. I had seen him many times, but now, for the first time, I noticed what I should have noticed before, that he invariably wore a hi-hat, or topper, as our customers like to call them. I observed that the shape was awful, and that the hat badly needed the iron, and then my mind recurred to the old problem of the vacant space in the top of top hats. But I found I could not concentrate. Whenever I tried to think of top hats, I thought of Walshingham Gribbs in one of them, staggering and reeling up the street, and gradually the thought came that it would be an excellent idea should I be able so to use the space in the top of Walshingham's hat that he would no longer stagger and reel. And then the thought of the gyroscope hat came to me. I admit that at first I put the idea aside as futile, but it came back again and again, and at length it seemed to force me into enthusiasm. I dropped everything and went to work on the gyro hat. The gyroscope is, as everyone knows, a top, and I might have called the hat I invented a top hat, except that any tall cylindrical silk or beaver hat is called a top hat, so I was forced to adopt the name gyro hat. A gyroscope is not an ordinary top. It is like a heavy flywheel revolving on an axis, and if it is spun, the speed of the revolutions maintains the axes in the perpendicular. A huge gyroscope is used to steady the channel streamers, which would otherwise stagger and reel. A gyroscope has just been adopted to the monorail cars, and so long as the gyroscope gyrates, the monorail car cannot stagger or reel. If a proper gyroscope were placed on the end of a knitting needle and gyrated at full speed, that knitting needle could be stood on end and it would not fall over. Therefore, if a gyroscope was placed in the top of a top hat, and the top hat firmly fastened to the head of a man, and the gyroscope set going, that man would remain perpendicular in spite of everything. He could not stagger, he could not reel, he would walk a line as straight as a crack. When I had completed this gyro hat, I showed it to my wife, and briefly explained what it was and what I meant to do with it. The small but wonderfully powerful motor and the gyroscope itself were all concealed inside the hat, and I explained to my wife that Walshingham Gribbs need but fasten the hat firmly on his head, and he would never stagger again. At first my wife seemed doubtful, but as I went on she became enthusiastic. The only thing she disliked was the method of fastening the hat to the head, for as it was quite necessary that the hat be very firmly affixed to the head, I had sewn ear tabs to the hat, and these I tied firmly under my chin. My wife said she feared it would require some time to persuade the public to take silk top hats with ear tabs, and that the sight of a man in a silk hat with ear tabs would be a sign that he was a staggerer. She wanted another method of holding the hat on the head. "Vacuum suction," I said, for I am quick to catch an idea. "A man has to be in the hat business." "But," I added, "where would you get the vacuum? A man cannot be expected to carry a can of vacuum, or whatever he would need to carry vacuum in, around with him, especially the kind of man who would need a gyro hat." "My dear," said my wife, after a moment of thought, during which we both studied the gyro hat, "I have it. Let the hat make its own vacuum. If the hat is lined with airtight aluminium, and has a rubber sweatband, and an expulsive valve, the gyroscope motor could pump the air out itself. It could create its own vacuum." "Of course it could," I exclaimed. "I could rig it up so that putting the hat on the head would start the gyroscope, and the gyroscope would pump a vacuum. All any staggerer would need to do would be to put the hat on his head, and the hat would do the rest. It would stay on his head, and it would keep him evenly on his keel." Of course, I would never use a nautical term like keel in my hat shop, but at home I allow myself some liberties like that sort. I set to work at once to perfect the gyro hat on the plan suggested by my wife, and in a few days I was able to say it was a success. By this I mean it was a success insofar as the eye could judge by looking at the hat, and all that needed was a practical trial. As the hat had been invented for Walshingham Gribbs, more than any other man, I proposed to my wife that Walshingham, we had spoken of him so often that we now mentioned him as Walshingham, should be the man to try it out. But my wife is better posted in social matters than I, and she said it would not do at all to attempt such a thing. In the first place, none of us knew Walshingham. And in all other places, it would be insulting to suggest such a thing to him, and might ruin Anne's chances. I then assured my wife I did not mean to allow any ordinary intoxicated man to experiment with the only gyro hat I possessed, and possibly wreck and ruin it. We had too much at stake for that. So after considerable discussion, my wife and I decided upon what was, after all, the only rational course. I should try out the gyro hat myself. I admit here I am not much of a drinker. Although not so by principle, I am by action a teetotaler. I consider that the highest good of a hat shop demands it. As a matter of fact, I have never, up to this time, tasted intoxicating liquor, but it was evident to my wife and me that the time had arrived when the hat business demanded this sacrifice on my part. Evidently, if a gyro hat is meant to keep a staggerer and reeler steady on his keel, the only test of the gyro hat must be on the head of a man who, without the hat, could not help staggering and reeling. A thoroughly intoxicated man. We did not, of course, admit Anne into our little conspiracy, and we chose a restaurant where we would be sure intoxicants would be sold. We proceeded to the restaurant about the dinner hour, and after studying the waiters carefully, I selected one that seemed likely to know something about intoxicants, and we seated ourselves at his table. I placed the gyro hat carefully across my knees, first setting the starter, and beckoned the waiter to us. "My good fellow," I said, when he approached with his pencil and order card in hand, "I desire to become intoxicated this evening, and I presume you know something about intoxicating liquors." "Yes, sir," said the waiter. "Tell him, Henry," said my wife, "that we also wish to eat, but that as our principal object in coming here is to secure intoxicants, we wish him to be particular about them." "You have heard what the lady said," I told the waiter, "and you will be guided accordingly." "Yes, sir," said the waiter politely. "Does the lady desire to become intoxicated also?" "Heavens no," exclaimed my wife. "Certainly not," said the waiter. "Now," I said to the waiter, "you doubtless have different kinds of intoxicating liquors here, some strong and some not so strong, and I do not desire to drink a great quantity to obtain the result I desire. What would you recommend to give the required reeling and staggering condition as quickly as possible?" "Well, sir," he said, "if you will let me advise, I would advise a certain brandy we have. Of that brandy, sir, a little goes a long way. I have seen it work, sir, and I can assure you that a small quantity of that will make you stagger and reel to your heart's content." "Very well," I said, "you may bring me some. I suppose a quart would be enough?" "I beg your pardon, sir," he said, "but have you ever tried the brandy of which I speak?" "I have not," I said. "Then, sir," said the waiter apologetically, "unless you are a very heavy drinker, I would not advise a quart of that brandy. A quart of that brandy, sir, would, if I may so speak, lay you out flat. You would not reel and stagger, sir. You would be paralyzed stiff, sir. Dead to the world." I thanked the waiter warmly. "You observe," I said, "that I am not used to this sort of thing, and I appreciate the interest you are taking. I am inclined to leave the matter entirely in your hands. I may not know when I have had exactly the right quantity, but you, with your larger experience, will know, sir." "Yes, sir, and I think the lady will know, sir," said the waiter. I found the brandy most unpleasant to the taste, but certain symptoms assured me that the waiter had not belied its effectiveness. Long before the waiter was satisfied that I would stagger and reel, my long-lost vocal prowess returned, and I caroled gaily some songs that had been favorites of my youth. Many of these were affectionate songs, and when I sang them, I had a great longing to hold my wife's hand, and did so. But as she would not let me kiss her, I felt the need of kissing the waiter. Here again I was repulsed, but it did not make me angry. I merely slid down into my chair and waved my hand at him coquettishly. "If you please, sir," said the waiter, when I had finished another burst of song, "I think you are pretty ripe now. If you would just get up and walk a few steps, I can tell more definitively." My wife smiled at me reassuringly, and nodded to me that what the waiter proposed had her full sanction. But even so, I was filled with a fear that we were about to be parted forever, and for a few minutes I clung to her neck, weeping bitter tears. I then tore myself away, and I did indeed stagger and reel. I believe I knocked over two small tables, and ended by seating myself in the lap of a young man who was dining alone. He accepted my apology before I had spoken more than 15 minutes of it, and then he aided the waiter in steering me back to my table. Whatever had been my past opinion of Walsingham Gribbs, for it was he, I loved him most dearly in that moment, and in my incoherent manner I tried to tell him so. I think he understood. At any rate, he spoke to my wife like a true gentleman. "Madam," he said, "I can sincerely sympathize with your husband, and if you will allow me, I will gladly help assist him to a cab. I beg you not be frightened by his condition, for I myself am subject to the same trouble. And although he may seem drunk—" "Seem drunk!" exclaimed my wife. "Seem drunk? I beg you to know that my husband is as drunk as a man can become without being senseless. Either that, or we have been defrauded by this waiter." Walsingham Gribbs looked at my wife, and then smiled. "Very well," he said. "If what you wanted was to have him drunk, I'll admit that he is about the drunkest man I have ever seen. I only spoke as I did in order that I might spare your feelings, for most wives object to seeing their husbands stagger and reel. I myself stagger and reel continually, and have never tasted intoxicating liquor in my life. But I can share the feelings of one who staggers and reels, or who has a relative that staggers and reels." At this, my wife said, "Are you not Walsingham Gribbs? If you are, I am delighted to have met you, even in this most unconventional manner, for what brought us here will interest you." She then told him of the gyro hat I had invented, and explained just why I had come to this place and swallowed the strong brandy. I took no part in this conversation, but Walsingham gladly agreed to accompany us, and he put the gyro hat on my head. The result was indeed marvelous. Instantly, the pump began to work and the gyroscope to revolve. My head, which had been lying on one side, straightened up. The rubber sweatband gripped my head tightly with a slight pulling sensation. Without assistance, I arose from my chair and stood erect. My brain was still confused, but I walked as straight as a string direct to the door of the restaurant and stood holding it open while my wife and Walsingham passed out. The gyroscope was revolving at a rate of 3,000 revolutions a minute, and the slight humming was hardly noticeable. I did not stagger, and I did not reel. When I reached Gramercy Park, I was full of glee. I had been walking on the edge of the curb, but now I desired to climb atop the iron fence that surrounds the park and walk on the points of the pickets. My wife and Walsingham tried to dissuade me, but I climbed to the top of the fence. I not only walked along the points of the pickets easily, but I was able to place the end of one toe on the point of one picket, and thus balanced, waved the other leg in the air. My wife and Walsingham Gribbs coaxed me to come down to the level of the walk, but as I saw no reason to, I flatly refused. And at last Walsingham reached up, took me by the hand, and pulled me. Ordinarily, a man that had imbibed a quantity of brandy would have fallen to the street if pulled by one hand while standing on top of a row of pickets. But I did not. While Walsingham pulled by the hand, I inclined gently towards him until I was at right angles to the picket fence, with my feet still on top of the pickets, and when he released my hand, I slowly swung upright again, without any effort whatever on my part. I got down off the fence when I was ready, and not before. There can be no doubt whatever that I was far more intoxicated than Walsingham Gribbs, and all the way home I gave vent to tremendous bursts of laughter over the idea that while Walsingham thought he was seeing me safely home, I walked as straight and true as a general, and he staggered and reeled except when he clung closely to my arm. Many persons stopped and looked at us, and I cannot wonder at it, for Walsingham is a young man of most dignified countenance, and it must have seemed strange to see a young man of such sober mien reeling drunkenly, while a dignified and steadily walking hatter laughed and shouted drunkenly. It was as if the two of us had been able to afford but one spree, and had divided it in that way, he taking the stagger, and I taking the boisterousness. My wife was much touched by the kind attentions of Walsingham, And when we reached home, she invited him in, and while I found a little harmless amusement in walking up the stair banisters and sliding down them, standing on my feet, which I was able to do because of the steadying effects of the gyro hat, she took Walshingham into the parlor and introduced him to Anne formally. My poor daughter was quite overcome with embarrassment and pleasure, but when Walshingham was sitting, he showed no evidence of his stagger and reel whatever, and they managed to become quite well acquainted while my wife was assisting me to bed. Unfortunately, I had neglected to arrange any method for letting the vacuum out of the gyro hat, and although my wife tugged and pulled at the hat, the suction held fast to my head, and it refused to come off unless my scalp came with it. My wife decided I must sleep in the hat, since I was in no condition of mind to do anything about it myself. I was dying for sleep, and my wife tumbled me into bed and pulled the sheet over me, and that same instant I fell into a heavy slumber. But the moment my wife released her grasp on me, I began rising to my feet, irresistibly drawn to the perpendicular by the action of the gyro hat. I continued to rise until I was standing upright. I can only liken the manner in which I arose to the way a man may raise a stiff arm slowly until it pointed straight upward. My wife immediately pushed me down onto the pillow again, but it was unavailing. Again the gyro hat drew me into a standing position, and my wife was forced to let me continue my night's rest in that position. The next morning I did not feel very well, but I never saw my wife in better spirits. She told me she was sure Walshingham had taken a great fancy to Anne, for he had asked permission to call again that evening, and my wife said that in her opinion it would be well to take up the matter of marriage with Walshingham at once before it went any further. If he meant business, he would be glad to wear the hat and be rid of his stagger and reel. And if he meant nothing, it would be a good thing to know at once, and the sooner we were rid of him, the better. I agreed with her fully, but I spent the day perfecting the vacuum outlet on the hat. I must admit that Walshingham seemed somewhat surprised when I made the suggestion to him that evening. For a few minutes he did not seem to know what to say. Perhaps it was a little overcoming to have the parents of Anne suggest the idea of marriage in this offhand manner, and at the same time propose the wearing of a gyro hat. But Walshingham was a gentleman, and when he glanced up, after his first surprise, and saw Anne gazing at him appealingly with her hands clasped, I could see love had won. But instead of acquiescing immediately, Walshingham Gribbs took one of Anne's hand in his, and after patting it, spoke directly to me. "Sir," he said, "I cannot but appreciate the delicate manner in which you have handled this matter. But if I am only too glad to find that there is a hat that will correct my unfortunate staggering and reeling, and if I am glad to accept your offer of that hat, I feel it due to myself to assure you that liquor has nothing whatever to do with my staggering and reeling. I am the victim of an unfortunate experience of my youthful days. My father was a man of many ideas, and always trying to make the world better. He had a neighbor that had a mule. It was a mouse-colored mule, and very stubborn, and it used to wring my father's heart to see the neighbor belabor the mule with a heavy whip, trying to make the mule proceed in a direction which it did not wish to go. The mule was quite willing to go toward the barn where the feed was kept, but it often refused to go in the opposite direction, although it would go well enough if once started. My father, therefore, conceived the idea of what he called the Gribbs Mule Reverser. This was a circular platform large enough to hold a mule and his loaded wagon, and beneath the platform was a motor capable of revolving the platform. All that was necessary was to place the mule and the wagon on the platform and start the mule in the direction of home, and then suddenly turn the platform in the direction the mule was desired to go, and the mule would proceed, unwittingly, in that direction. "A very excellent idea," I said. "Except that it would not work in the least," said Walshingham. "In the first place, it was necessary to dig a pit 5 feet square beneath the revolving platform to contain the motor, and this was not always convenient. In the second place, the platform and motor would hardly ever happen to be where the mule balked, and it would have been a great deal easier to load the mule on a wagon than to load the platform and the motor on 3 wagons. And in the third place, if the mule would not start homeward, neither would it start onto the platform of the mule reverser." So, after my father had tried the platform in our backyard, with a mule on it, and the revolutions had thrown the mule against the side of the barn, breaking both the mule and the barn, he decided that other things were better to invent and abandon the platform. I and the lads of the neighborhood found this a good place to play, and one day I was standing exactly in the center of the platform when one of the boys happened to start the motor. I had sense enough to remain exactly in the center of the platform, or I would have been thrown off and possibly killed, for the platform was revolving at the rate of 8,000 revolutions a minute. The motor had power to revolve the platform slowly when loaded with a mule and loaded wagon, so it was capable of immense speed with only a small boy on it. When my companions saw what they had done, continued Walshingham, they all ran away, and for 4 hours I remained in the center of that platform, being revolved at enormous speed. And when my father came home and stopped the platform, I staggered and reeled and fell in a heap at his feet. That is how I acquired my unfortunate stagger and unpleasant reel, and I have only told you this that you may have no unjust suspicions. But why? Asked my wife, who had been greatly interested by Walshingham's story. Do you not simply revolve in the opposite direction and unwind yourself, as we used to say? Madam, said Walshingham, I have. Every night for 1 hour before I go to bed I revolve, but it requires an immense number of revolutions to overcome such a spin as I had in my youth. He waited a moment and then said, But I am now ready to try the gyro hat. I looked out the window and hesitated. A thin rain was falling, and was freezing as it fell, and I hated to have a good silk gyro hat go out in such weather. But, as a leading hatter, I felt it would never do for me to seem small and picayunish in regard to hats. I remembered that a really good silk hat should not be ruined by a few drops of water, and I saw that if anything could convince Anne and Walshingham that the gyro hat held their happiness, it would be a trial on such slippery walks as the evening had provided. So I brought down the hat and pressed it on Walshingham's head. Instantly the vacuum creator began to work, and the hat clung fast to his head. He rose to his feet and walked across the parlor in a perfectly steady manner and out into the hall. I held open the front door, and he stepped out. Walshingham crossed the porch with as steady a tread as ever any man crossed the porch of a high-class hatter. But when he reached the top step, his foot struck ice and he slipped. He did not stagger or reel. If he fell steadily. I can best liken his fall to the action of a limber reed when the wind strikes it. He inclined slowly, with his feet still on the top step, and continued to incline until his head touched the walk below with considerable violence, and then his feet slipped down the edges of the steps until they rested on the walk. I never saw a more graceful fall, and I was about to congratulate Walshingham when he began to incline upward toward the perpendicular again in the same slow manner. But this was not the reason I held my words. The reason was that the gyro hat and Walshingham were behaving in the most unaccountable manner. Walshingham was revolving. I discovered later that the fall had jammed the gyroscope on the pivot so that the gyroscope could not revolve without revolving the whole hat, and as the hat was firmly suctioned to Walshingham, the hat could not revolve without revolving Walshingham. For an instant, Walshingham revolved away from us down the walk, and Anne gave a great cry. But almost at that moment, Walshingham regained the upright and began to revolve rapidly. The icy walk offered no purchase to his feet, and this was indeed lucky, for if it had, his head would have continued to revolve nonetheless, and the effect would have been fatal. I estimated that Walshingham was revolving at a rate of perhaps 1,500 revolutions a minute, and it was some minutes before my wife was able to recover from the shock of seeing her prospective son-in-law whirl thus to ask me to stop him. My first impulse was to do so, but my long training as a hatter had made me a careful, thoughtful man, and I gently pushed my wife back. At 6 in the morning, I called Anne and my wife, and we went into the yard to stop Walshingham. It was not until I had carefully walked down the porch steps that it came to me that I had no way of stopping him whatever. To add to my dismay, I knew that when the sun arose, the thin ice would melt, and as Walshingham's feet could no longer slip easily, he would in all probability be wrenched in two, a most unsatisfactory condition for a son-in-law. My dear, I said, let us pause and consider this case. Here we have Walshingham revolving rapidly. He is revolving in one of the only two directions in which he can revolve. The direction in which he revolved on the mule reverser, or the opposite direction. If it is in the opposite direction, all is well, for he will be unwound in a few hours, if his neck is not wrung in the meantime. If it is in the same direction, it's no use to stop him now, for by this time he will be in such a condition of reeling and staggering that we would not have him as a son-in-law on any terms. I propose, therefore, to let him spin for a few hours, when he will have had a full recovery, or be permanently too dizzy for any use. My wife, and Anne too, saw the wisdom of this course, and as it was very miserable weather outside, we all withdrew to my parlor, from the window of which we could watch Walshingham revolve. Occasionally, when he seemed about to revolve off the walk, I went out and pushed him back on again. I figured that by 6 o'clock in the morning he would be sufficiently revolved, provided he was revolving in the right direction, and at midnight I sent my wife and Anne to bed. I fear Anne slept but little that night, for she must have had a lover's natural anxiety as to how all was to turn out. But while I was standing in dismay, love found a way, as love always will, and Anne rushed to the cellar and brought out the stepladder and the ice pick. Placing the stepladder close to Walshingham, she climbed it, and holding the point of the ice pick at the exact center of the top of the hat, she pushed down. In a moment, a sizzing sound told us that she had bored a hole in the hat, letting the vacuum escape, and the hat flew from Walshingham's head. Slower and slower he revolved until he stood quite still, and then, without a reel or a stagger, he walked up to me and grasped my hand while tears told me the thanks he could not utter. He had revolved in the right direction. He was cured.
That was The Experiment in Gyro Hats by Ellis Parker Butler. I hope it tickled you as much as it did me. I don't think I've ever heard such a hilarious description of someone getting drunk in my life. And please keep in mind, before writing in to explain that gyroscopes don't work that way, I'm pretty sure you can't unwind people either. But I, for one, was happy to suspend my disbelief long enough to enjoy the image of a drunk hatter staggering along the top of an ironwork fence. The illustrations that go with the story are hilarious too. I'll link to the copy on archive.org for your delectation. And incidentally, if you feel like indulging in a bit more of that style of humour after the show, can I recommend Punch Brother Punch by Mark Twain? I'll provide links to the text and to Cory Doctorow's narration of it from his podcast in the show notes. If either of these stories tickled you, we'd love to hear about it. Feel free to drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click on the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbauer, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 33, where we'll have some spine-tingling horror with The Whistling Corpse by G.G. Pendarves. So please remember that if you must get drunk, strictly for scientific purposes, of course, that a public restaurant in front of your future son-in-law might not be the best circumstance. And have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.